Welcome. Welcome all to K-Drama School. I'm your host, Grace Jung, and class is now in session. Back to my podcast, folks. I know that I was on a bit of a hiatus for the last several months. How many months is it total? I guess since October's October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June. So about 8 months of a break. And I guess I needed this break. I know that I've been threatening to give up my podcast and quit it like multiple times. Even when I was in LA, I'm still in Madison, Wisconsin, by the way, for those of you wondering. I'm sorry that I was missing. I'm sorry that this went on hiatus without any notice and without any updates, but I really had underestimated how much teaching would take over my schedule and my life. And you know what? It wasn't a bad thing at all. I actually really enjoyed teaching. My teaching stint at UW-Madison lasted about 9 months. It is now over. And so I have my time back. I know that I was doing my podcast when I was still a graduate student, or like winding down from my graduate studies. And then my life for listeners have actually witnessed me transitioning out of being a grad student into being just an unemployed scholar for a long time, and then witnessed my temporary employment. We're back to unemployment again, for those of you wondering. I am now back to being self-employed, and I am also still living in Madison. And you know what? I'm going to stay here for a little while. I don't know what my next move is. I really don't know what the future holds for me, but I don't care either. I was caring a great deal once the period was over and I was kind of wrapped up in panic for a minute there. But then, like, I don't know. For those of you who had witnessed me spring of 2024, you all know how terrible things were for me back then. And I got myself out of it, you know? So, well, I mean, myself, the powers that be. In any case, things have a way of working themselves out. So I am back to just writing at this moment. I'm going to be working on my next book project, and that is currently in the works. My time at UW-Madison was a good one. I met so many wonderful people during my stint there. I also met some shitty ones. Not gonna lie. I mean, you get the good, you're gonna get the bad. I guess some of my favorite people are still friends of mine. One of them I am in a writing group with. We meet on a weekly basis, and we're both working on our first academic monographs. So while she's working on hers, I'm working on mine. And the only difference is while doing that is she has access to library resources and journal articles and books, and I don't. It's as soon as my visiting assistant professorship was over, it's library card canceled. Can't log into any of the stuff that I was able to access. So if you're at a university and you have access to library resources, and you would like to find a book for me, the book is called Political Economy of Affect and Emotions in East Asia. I think that's the title. And it's a Routledge book, and those books tend to cost $150 to $200 a copy, and I'm not going to pay for that. So if you have access to an online copy and could turn it into a PDF and send it to me, that'd be so sweet. Yeah. I am very much working on my academic monograph. I'm also working on a new fiction project. I mean, it's not new. I've written the bare bones structure of it, and then I had it typed out as a first draft manuscript a week or two ago. And now I'm in the process of redrafting and fleshing it out. And And once it's done, I'm going to send it to my agent and see where that goes. Yeah. We've been here before, right, folks? Like, you've all seen Grace Jung right here in this very position once before. The only difference is she is now a little more experienced. She's not starting from square one. And she's a little more confident than she was once before. So we'll see how this goes. What I've noticed about Korean media studies generally, like I remember in the fall when I was working on when I last did my podcast episode, there was a lot of hope in the air about where Korean media studies can go in terms of its direction. But like, no, I realize, no, universities are still very much like uptight. They want somebody who is going by the book and doing the same old boring shit. Like, that's what they want, somebody that they feel safe around, you know, because at the end of the day, these institutions are occupied by people who want somebody just like themselves, you know, somebody who feels like a non-threat. This was sort of the pushback that I was experiencing when I was there. It's like people who would look at my CV and my otherworldly experiences working in entertainment, like they thought that was like either silly and dismissive or easy to dismiss, or a threat to them in some way. I don't think any of that should be a threat. I don't think any of them should be dismissed, because, you know, my experiences are just the way that they are. But like, you there's no way for me to control how people feel about me, right? Like, there really isn't. You know what, that did kind of like fuck with me for a while. I was like, again, you know, dealing with this notion, like, have I been living my life wrong entirely? Like, but it wasn't as dramatic this time. I did feel this like deep inner rage that came to my defense and said, no, they're wrong. Again, these are fragile egos that never pursued the things that they wished they had pursued. They're just mad that somebody who did pursue those things is kind of, she kind of has her feet in both places, in the world of arts where she's working, and then the world of academia where she is trying to situate herself more firmly and work and thrive and get and make a living out of it. And this isn't anything new. I feel like I've been like going off about this for like decades now, and it hasn't changed. If any of you have read my book, Delhi Ideology, I very much go into the issues that I have with this. But it's like, why do I continue to remain in academia? I don't know. It's like, I don't know how else to be. I do love knowledge. I do love the idea of producing thought that is liberating. Yeah. So for me then, like, at least I have clarity there. Like, why do I do what I do? Why do I do it? And it is like, it's because I want to find some kind of freedom in thought. How do I break out of this kind of thinking about this, right? I mean, that's the job of a philosopher. And that is something I talk to my guest about, Will Franken, who is a Madison-based comedian, also a UW-Madison, not quite alum because he didn't graduate, but he was there long enough. And he is somebody I consider a friend, very funny comedian, and overall good person. Yeah. And very smart guy. He says a lot of like very wise things. And I'm like, oh yeah, like I'm about this shit. Oh fuck yeah. You know, for such a young person to like have such an expansive worldview, I think that's a good thing. I am in a new relationship, a new partnership. They are very good for me. And It has been a very healing experience in a lot of ways. It has been a kind of a growth period for me on an emotional level. And I've also been very much like putting my energy into this new relationship and nurturing that. In fact, this current studio space is in our residence. Yeah, this is like the other bedroom that I've kind of turned into my own studio space / office. And I'm with somebody who like allows me these kinds of things. And that's been, honestly, it's been really wonderful for me. I've also been like going fishing recently, like, because this person likes to fish. This person is also a hunter. They like to go hunting. So yeah, I've done that too, which is very new for me. Especially like a liberal chica who grew up in New York, where gun control was very strict, like suddenly ending up in the Midwest where everybody has like a concealed weapon license and, you know, like a gun locker or whatever. Yeah, like this is all very new. I have gone shooting a couple of times. I both love it and hate it. Like, it is very loud. It is very powerful and terrifying. But at the same time, like, there is a certain thrill about it. And I was just kind of thinking, like, you know what? Like, of all the people who own guns right now in America, I feel like women of color should know how to use guns better than anybody. I'm just kind of getting that shit down. Fish come to me pretty naturally. Like, I caught 3 fish in 1 weekend, you know, very effortlessly. I am not a fisher. Like, I've gone fishing maybe, like, 1 other time. Yeah, and I didn't catch anything then. But then this time, like, I just, like, threw the rod, threw out the line, and just caught 3 bass, no problem. Something else I learned, you know, these, like, freshwater bass, yeah, fishers don't eat them. They think it's, like, it's a, I don't know, it's, like, frowned upon to eat those fish. And again, the answer for this is very vague. Like, I've asked about it, I've researched it. They're like, well, first of all, bass doesn't taste good, so that's like the one reason. The other reason, they're like, bass are like dirty fish, so it's like, don't eat them. But I'm like, aren't all fish kind of like eating the same thing, more or less? I don't know. So anyway, yeah, they don't eat them. Also, muskies, like, muskie is like a big ass fish. It's like very much a thing here locally, like catching a muskie is a big deal, but they don't eat them. They just catch and release. So yeah, I've been doing that. I've been catching fish, tearing them up on the inside and around them, and then throwing them back out into the water. It's weird. It's weird to do, but been doing that. So that's my update. And I'm going to continue my podcast just as I see fit. I don't know if I'm going to be doing it like regularly, but I definitely do have like a list of people that I want to interview and that I want to like include in my podcast and put out into the world. So if you're joining me for that journey, then here we are. Like, this is me in a different environment, different setting, different part of my life, doing something that is like old, but also in a new way. So I invite you all on this journey with me, and I'm very excited to proceed forward. So thank you for your kind listenership, as always. And folks, I have been promoting my book, K-Drama School, A Pop Culture Inquiry into Why We Love Korean Television. And I've done a book festival here. I flew out to New York to be part of another festival. I did a couple of readings here, and all of it has been very wonderful and rewarding. And honestly, like, I think the book festival that I did here was the most fun, because there were so many like K-drama fans there who just ask like the best questions, or just ask ridiculous questions that I just like to have fun with. So that's been all really wonderful. And yeah, if you haven't read the book yet, you can get it. You can get it as an audiobook, ebook, hardcover. It is available on Amazon, Walmart, Target, wherever you get your books. You guys can find this book. If your local bookstore does not have it, you can definitely order it. If your local library doesn't have it, you can also ask them to order it. I have seen that a lot of the Midwest libraries do have my book, so that's a good thing. If you cannot find it, again, just ask a librarian, ask your local bookstore. I would encourage you to ask your local bookstore owner, though, right? It's good to promote local businesses, support local businesses. In fact, my book was, I gave a reading at a bookstore called A Room of One's Own here in Madison, which is a queer-owned bookstore, and their proceeds do go to helping out queer causes. So yeah, that's been a wonderful experience. If you're in Madison, you could find a signed copy at A Room of One's Own. And yeah, just go and support your local businesses wherever you can. Folks, today's show that I'll be covering is called When Life Gives You Tangerines. If you've seen this show, you would already know what a moving show it is. It's definitely like the kind of show that like is riding off the coattails of the Reply series, right? Like Reply 1997, Reply 1994, Reply 1988. It's got that nostalgic element where you like go back in time and you kind of see like the nostalgic aesthetics of that period, like the products, the hairstyles, the makeup, the clothes, right? And even like there's even like a nostalgia for the kind of crises of those time periods, right? Like this show definitely does it. It's been done in all those other series. Like, why wouldn't they do it in this one, right? So there is kind of like that copycat element, or at least a continuation of that. So that's very much visible in When Life Gives You Tangerines. The writer of this show is Im Sang-chun, and she wrote another show that I really, really love called When the Camellias Bloom. And what I love about like both of these shows is like how diverse the representation of femininity is, and how also like it doesn't really have much shame or secrecy around like female sexuality and pleasure. Yeah. So that I love. And in fact, a lot of the K-dramas I've been seeing lately do promote female sexuality in a bolder way. There's like a bolder expression of female sexuality in those shows. And I'm going to be covering that bit by bit as we proceed forward. So yeah, more emphasis on female sexuality in K-dramas. This is something I'm down with for sure. The show stars a beloved icon, IU, and she is really like doing a lot, very versatile on this show. She is playing like two different characters. She's playing the mother or the main protagonist, and then she plays that mother's daughter, who is like another, I guess, another significant character on the show. We also have Park Bo-gum. Park Bo-gum's role on this show is like very interesting because it's like somewhat limited. You know, he's like on it for maybe like half the series, like, or maybe not even. And then his role gets taken over by Park Hye-jun. Park Hye-jun, I guess if you've seen World of the Married, which is a show I love. Yeah, Park Hye-jun was like on that, made it big on that for sure. And in this one, like Park Hye-jun plays like a very sensitive role. Park Bo-gum also plays a very sensitive role. I felt like Park Bo-gum playing that sensitive, like soft daddy role was more convincing than Park Hye-jun. Because Park Hye-jun, I don't know, there's like a severity to him. Like he's not as convincing to me to be like this wholesome, sweet guy. I don't know. It doesn't really work for me. Not very convincing. And then you have Moon So-ri. Holy cow. Like she is top icon for me. I really, really love Moon So-ri. I think she is like so immensely talented. I think she is a genius in terms of like performance. She's versatile not only in cinema, like she's done so many amazing movies, especially with Lee Chang-dong, right? Like I think I've talked about this, but she's done like Peppermint Candy. Yeah, she's done Oasis. Oh my gosh, have you guys seen Oasis? That film, you gotta see. She plays like a person who has cerebral palsy in that film, and she falls in love with somebody who is also like neurodivergent, and the whole film is about that relationship and how like heteronormative standards are keeping them apart or trying to separate them in some way. Yeah. Moon So-ri is married to filmmaker Chang Jun-hwan, and Chang Jun-hwan is interesting because he made a really strange movie called Save the Green Planet. It's this indie art house movie. I think the distribution company that I used to work for, like way back in the day, I think they distributed this movie very briefly. But yeah, that film kind of had like a cult following in the US. And then in Korea, I think it was just considered like kind of okay, you know, like in terms of reception, but everybody did consider it like very like original and unique. So anyway, the husband of Moon So-ri is this filmmaker, Chang Jun-hwan, and this movie, Save the Green Planet, is actually being remade by Yorgos Lanthimos. So, holy cow. For those of you who don't know who Yorgos Lanthimos is, you know who he is. Yeah, you've seen Poor Things. You've seen The Lobster. You know, you've seen Dogtooth. So, yeah, like, and there's another interesting connection there, because Dogtooth and Save the Green Planet, they were both distributed by the same film company here in the United States, based in New York. Yeah, I used to work for them for a long time. Anyway, yeah, going back to Munsori, she was also in that show, what is it? The Nurse Files? Yeah, like the Nurse Files one, the one with all the jellies and the blobs. Yeah, Munsori plays like the shaman in that film. In fact, Munsori plays a shaman a lot. She was in like another film called like Manshin, which is like a semi-documentary hybrid with narrative implemented. And then in the narrative part, like Munsori is playing a shaman in that. Like, yeah, all around badass. Queen Maker. Munsori was in Queen Maker, right? So anyway, you guys, if you haven't seen When Life Gives You Tangerines, if you want to see something that's like wholesome, gives you like warm and fuzzy feelings inside, right? Like it's not just like a tragic melodrama making you gush and like tears you apart. No, there is hope, there is glimmer, there is shimmer, there is like, there's all this goodness in this show that just like makes you want to keep on going. And I feel like I need that. Yeah, so I actually watched this show twice because it was so life-giving to me. And it's also set on Jeju Island for the most part, which is like a beautiful place. So yeah, check the show out. And yeah, now let's transition into our talk with my buddy and local comedian, Will Franken.
The other day I was walking in the rain with an umbrella, but then it was like humid out, so yeah. I'm still wet from sweat, but yeah. I was using an umbrella in the rain. It's like, no. I could have just walked.
Humidity, I think, is probably the worst.
Yeah.
Because it's like the air is already hot, but then it's also moisture. Mm-hmm. So it's like encasing you.
Yeah. It's like it makes me feel claustrophobic sometimes.
The humidity makes you feel claustrophobic.
Yeah, does that work that way?
The humidity makes you afraid of small spaces?
Well, it feels like I'm in a small space because of the humidity.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. The encasement.
Yeah.
The entrapment.
Yeah. I went to Texas and my friends were telling me that, it's so hot down here, dude. I'm like, it gets hot everywhere. Like,
it's true.
And then I was there and I was like, holy shit.
It's another level.
It is hot.
Yeah. Where in Texas were you?
College Station. My friends went to A&M, so.
Okay.
And that place is weird.
Why?
Well, I mean, are you familiar with College Station?
No.
So it's a city just made for Texas A&M. It's not a city, like, other than that, basically. And
so it's literally College Station
is the name of the city.
Literally a college station.
And it's actually a college station. Yeah. Like all the teachers and I mean, I guess that's everywhere, but there's like not like a downtown. It's just campus and then like housing.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And then they have a bar area that I guess you could call downtown. And it's like 25 bars in like a 3-block radius. And it's like,
and you went there for what?
Just to hang out.
To go to those bars?
Yeah.
To go to the 3 bars with your buddies?
Yeah. It was pretty funny. And I was underage and they were like sort of weird about it down there. And but we got through.
You made it through. Okay. That's good to hear. All right, Will. College Station sounds good. You speaking of College Station and college times tells me that you're still quite a young lad.
Mm-hmm. I'm 25.
You're 25. Baby boy.
Yeah.
Which school did you go to?
For college?
Yeah.
UW Madison.
And then
I dropped out after 4.5 years.
Right. We talked about this. Yeah.
It's not the ideal path, but I'm now employed and I get shows doing comedy. So some would say it was the ideal path.
It was the ideal path. Wait, what were you studying at the time?
Poli-sci. Yeah.
That's like the kind of thing people study when they don't know what they want to
exactly.
major in.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing. But I am interested in this stuff, like, a little bit, like, you know.
Like, what did you learn?
I mean, I don't know. I didn't study.
What's the one thing that stuck with you?
I took this class that was like the philosophy of conservative thinking.
Okay.
And it's not like conservatives like the, like Republicans nowadays. It's like John Locke, old conservative, like the birth of conservative thinking. And it's just like that. I'd say that class I retained the most information. It was pretty interesting.
What was it about that appealed to you so?
I think it was, well, first of all, I took it because I thought it was going to be like what you think of conservative nowadays.
So you wanted to take a class about like right-wing thought?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Because
what was the motive behind that?
Because I grew up in Madison and I've just been around like liberal thinking people my whole life. So I was like, you know, and at that time, well, I guess it was still crazy times back then, but it was a little less crazy. So I was like, you know, I'll hear him out.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't even about that.
Yeah.
And then I also have been interested in philosophy and
yeah.
So I was just like, I don't know. It's cool to see a lot of those thoughts that they had like way back in I don't know, the 1500s, 1600s or 1700s yeah. or whatever, like still be applied today. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you learned about John Locke.
Yeah. I can't remember any of the other ones.
Okay.
But
what was John Locke's thing?
He was like, I don't remember exactly, but the gist of like everybody's thing was you want to have unintended consequences. So like govern in a way that creates unintended consequences. So it'd be cool. I'd be reading this thing and I'm like, dude, this guy's crazy. Like he's like telling people or saying like we should never, I don't know. He would say like some crazy statement, like we can't help people with education or like the government shouldn't help people with education or something. And then, so then I'd be like, what? This guy's stupid. But then you keep reading, I'm like, oh, I see his point, but you know, I don't necessarily have to agree with it, but I start to see where they come from at least. And like,
okay.
I don't know. It was cool to be like reading. Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. So this is very interesting. So you grew up in Madison
mm-hmm.
and then you went to an excellent school, UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. In fact, I heard that it is very difficult for people who attended high school in Madison to get into UW-Madison.
Yeah.
That is like a very low, like.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, a lot of people from my high school went, but I know some people that had like better grades and stuff than me and didn't get in.
Oh, interesting. And,
so I don't know, it seems like there's no rhyme or reason to how they choose it.
Okay, that I can accept. Yeah, there actually really is no rhyme or reason for anything.
Yeah.
Okay, so because you grew up in Madison among very, very liberal people, or thought, as you put it, or liberal culture,
mm-hmm.
as you put it, you thought that maybe it's time for you to round out your mm-hmm. views by considering the origin of conservative thought.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, because it also stems from, like, if it's like when so many people are saying one thing, or like, a bunch of liberal people would be like, they're wrong, wrong, wrong. It's like, well, it can't all be wrong.
Right.
You know, like there's got to be some type of,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's what interested me. Is like,
yeah. This is interesting because technically, Abraham Lincoln, Republican.
Yeah.
Technically.
Yeah.
Like.
But the like, when people say that though, like, it's true, but the ideology's shifted. Like, I mean, the parties are like, no, like calling him a Republican is, you could call him a glass of water. I don't know. You know, like it just doesn't matter. The label of Republican doesn't matter.
It just doesn't apply anymore to like what we're thinking in today. So the conservative thought that you were studying was like from several, multiple centuries ago.
Yeah. Like even before America, I'm pretty sure.
Gotcha.
And then I think we went into some more modern thinkers, but
Okay. Okay, that's fascinating. Okay, this actually helps me a lot because I'm like currently on the job market because my term is up with UW-Madison. And I was just kind of like, just for fun, like kind of scrolling through like what jobs, mm-hmm. like what professor positions are currently open for this, at this university. And one of the jobs that are open is for this, like a professor of conservative thought.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And when I saw this, there was a part of me that was like, wait a minute, what the hell is this shit?
Yeah.
Because they don't have like a 10-year, you know, track search for a professor of liberal thought, you know. Yeah, like they
that
don't,
is interesting.
They don't have that. So why this, right? And then you're kind of pointing to something that's interesting too, which is that like even the word conservative doesn't have the same connotations as they did back then as they mm-hmm. do now. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, there's like, yeah, there's like, but my like final paper or whatever for that class was actually saying like a lot of things conservatives nowadays do are like nowhere even near conservative, is even like more liberal. Like they're like, my main point I think was like voting ID laws. It's like, my point was you're causing the government to do more things to make people to vote, and that's against the conservative ideology, and that was my opinion.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying like the way that conservatives are enforcing certain voting standards are more involved,
mm-hmm.
like yeah. less, it's actually not very like hands-off, it's actually yeah. very hands-on,
yeah,
very controlling, very hands-on. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah, okay, love this is great.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. All right, so okay, all this knowledge and intellect, and you decided, okay, fuck it, 4.5 years, done with UW Madison, not going to finish my degree. I'm sure you were like 2 credits away or something ridiculous.
Well, so I was like 20-ish, maybe like 25, okay. Something like that.
Aren't you 25 now?
No, but I mean credits away.
Oh, 25 credits away.
So, but my mistake was, so my first like 3 years... well, also COVID happened in the middle of my college career.
Okay.
So
yeah, that does change things.
And I just like loved partying too. Like I just loved drinking.
Sure.
And
like a true Scotty boy.
Yeah, I'm playing into the stereotype. But
So
I didn't even like contact my counselor or whatever to like see if I was even on the right track. I just mm-hmm. would sign up for classes.
Mm-hmm.
So that set me back. And then, I don't know, I just like... got this feeling where I was like, I don't need to do this shit. Like, I just felt like it didn't help me. I felt like it wasn't actually making me any more intelligent or anything. They were just like, I felt like they were just like making me do tricks or, you know, like,
yeah,
telling me to do stuff just yeah. for their enjoyment. I mean, obviously that's not yeah. true, but that was yeah. my mindset. But.
Yeah. Okay. That's actually a good point. Cause like sometimes, like when I'm on the other end, right? Like when I'm teaching, I feel the same way. I'm like, I'm glad that we're all here. I'm glad that they're taking my course. I'm glad that we're like interacting and getting to know one another and we're expanding our awareness about culture or whatever. But like, I hate assigning stuff and then I hate grading them. I hate having to give anybody like a standard of some kind to meet. It's so annoying.
Yeah, it just seems like their goal isn't really for you to retain the information.
Yeah.
It's just for you to do what you're told.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, I don't like that.
That actually is, I think, like the reason why schools and these institutions actually exist. It's because we have this thing called like a job force and a labor thing. And it's like, how do you justify somebody getting paid, or how do you justify somebody, right? Because of economy. And it's like, well, if they send out 3,000 emails versus this guy who sent 4 emails, they deserve a higher pay, or they deserve more credit, or whatever, right? It's like, you know?
It's all arbitrary. Like, or I don't know, like, you know, we're just... it's just stupid to like judge people based on if they can sit in front of a book and read it for 3 hours.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. It kind of is, because like, I mean, this is sort of something I've been grappling with like my whole adulthood, like since graduating college, because I graduated college into an economic recession, like 2009. And I was just like, what the hell was I studying for if the job market is this fucked?
Yeah.
And then, I did very well in school, you know, like I won awards and all this shit. And it's like, none of it amounted to anything in terms of like a salary or a decent job or anything like that. And then the same thing, like, it's like I didn't learn my lesson. I decided to go to grad school. I go all the way to the top, which is getting a doctorate degree. And then it's like the job market's fucked. I also graduated during the pandemic. And then I was just like, all right, I'm very learned, you know, I have all the degrees, but I'm like completely useless in the job market, it seems. Like
that's what they say, you know.
Yeah. Or that's how they make one feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if we try to ascribe value to ourselves based on these kinds of merits and standards, then that's always going to be,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and you're always like comparing yourself to the, it's like, who cares? I don't know.
Yeah. Just... So what do you do now?
I have a job that's similar to things I studied. I don't really want to
You don't want to talk about it.
Well, I can... So, fuck it. I'll just talk about it. I'm a lobbyist now.
You're a lobbyist. Fascinating.
Yeah. So, like... So, I had done an internship for a representative my, like, junior year or something.
Yeah.
And that year, I was, like, thinking, like... This is easy. Like,
yeah.
You tell me I've got to have to do another year and a half of school to do this.
Yeah.
So then, like, that's what I wanted to do. And then I did, like, some other internships and then, like, made some connections. And then this guy, I helped him out, like, last year with a little bit of things. And then, like, just this past, like December, he was like, you want to come on full time? And I was
beautiful. Yeah. So you didn't even need the school.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I felt. Yeah. But I definitely learned things from school, like,
yeah,
but yeah,
it also, you know, in a way, this is another way to look at it, like UW-Madison, excellent school, and it does kind of, like, if you have it on your CV or your resume, people go, oh, like, you went to this school, you know, like, or they're like, oh, I'm an alum from that school, or I know so-and-so who went to that school. Yeah. It's like a good sort of ticket, you know.
Yeah, but like, I mean, now I'm just, my views on school, I feel like, are a little ridiculous and also very biased because I dropped out.
Yeah.
But even that to me is like, it shouldn't even raise, you shouldn't even look at a school and be like, oh, this person, like that thing, that to me, like, I've heard in the field of law, like they for real, like firms will like weight Harvard graduates way more. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I get it because they're a longstanding institution that probably, they are the best probably. But it's like, you're writing off so many good candidates probably.
That is absolutely 100% true. Like, in fact, UW-Madison does that. People in my department would do that. A lot of the people in my department who got hired, this is the Asian Languages and Cultures department, they're all white. And they're teaching Asian Languages and Cultures. They all graduated from like Princeton, Columbia, Harvard, like for graduate school. And they're very proud of that. Like, that's like one of the first things that they'll drop. Be like, oh, I graduated Harvard and I was a faculty there for like 12 years. And I'm like, oh, I didn't ask.
Yeah.
Like, and also, I don't care. It seems like you care.
And that's like, they're only doing it to like get validation from, or that, I feel like school is so people can feel validated, but it's like, I feel validated.
You're like, every morning I look at myself in the mirror and I call myself beautiful and confident, and I already have inherent value.
I do that every morning.
Yeah. So when did you start growing your hair out?
Probably my sophomore year of college.
Oh, why?
It's like, the real answer is probably because I got into rock and roll and stuff and started like playing the guitar.
Oh, you still play?
Yeah, I play. Yeah, I don't play as much.
What kind of guitar you have?
It's a Jackson Explorer electric guitar. It looks pretty cool.
What color?
It's like red and then it fades into black, or it's red and then fades into black at the bottom.
Very emo. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so.
And were you in a band at the time?
No, I just, me and my friend like pretended to make music together, but I just honestly like just playing for fun. I hate putting pressure on something that I just enjoy doing, you know, like.
Interesting. Interesting. So did you participate in the Madison Comedy on State, the Madison's Best Comic competition? You did?
Yeah.
So comedy you don't love as much as music?
I don't know. I just feel like that's such a good opportunity to get shows and stuff. So that's what I did. But I didn't do good this year, so.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Next year.
Well, okay. I mean, since we've been talking about how arbitrary everything is, I feel like something like that is also just as ridiculous and arbitrary.
Yeah. And it's like, I actually do have that feeling of like, when I'm on stage, I have this weird like seriousness in the back of my mind where I'm like, I shouldn't have this while I'm doing comedy. Like, because it's this competition and I feel like that bleeds through and like they pick up on it somehow. Like,
yeah, that's actually really wise. And that is the truth. Like, whenever there's something going on subconsciously, the audience feels it subconsciously. Yeah.
Like, and it's a little bit of just a little more nervous because it's like, oh, a big thing and they put us in a green room
there
and it's
like,
oh,
cool. Involved. Yeah. So yeah. That,
like, bleeds through too, but it's like, and I like wanted to move forward. I am going to do it again, but if I don't do good again, I'm going to be like, it's just not for me. It's just like not the environment I want to do comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually the prime reason why, like, I never ever did comedy competitions. Like, there's so many comedy competitions, like, all over the country. A lot of them are roast battles. A lot of them are also like festivals too. It's like a comedy festival slash competition, and I would just like avoid them like the plague because I'm like, this is something I love doing. Why would I want to ruin it by turning it into the worst thing that exists, which is a competition?
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, actually, Noam Chomsky said that. He was like, competition is like the most useless thing ever. You know, it's like, it's like, why do that, especially in an educational environment? Why do that in a school? You know, so it's like, oh, then you could apply this to everything. Why do that with art?
It's weird. And especially for school, it's like, I get, they're like, oh, it's competitive, so it's hard. Well, it's like, I feel like the point, like I sort of said this earlier, the point is to retain the information, isn't it? So why are you making it so hard for us, you know?
It's to attain knowledge, right? Not even knowledge, but like, there's this like hippie lady that like I listen to. It's like a spiritual person. Yeah, and she was like, she got into Stanford when she was very young. Like when she was a teenager, she got into Stanford. And she went to Stanford looking for answers to life. And she realized Stanford doesn't have the answers. Like, she immediately found out. So that first year, she just partied and then she dropped out. And she was like, I was looking for wisdom. Stanford does not have wisdom. I'm like, none of the colleges have wisdom. None of them do, you know? So yeah, like, I'm right there with you. I think grades suck. I don't think they matter. I think university systems with this elitism and ranking system is bullshit. I think it sucks.
I agree.
I do think it is tragic that the educational system is so effed because, you know, like, students are being overcharged and professors are underpaid and people like me can't get jobs. I think that's why it does suck. However, I do feel like at the end of all of this, which is a nightmare. I mean, it's a nightmare for a lot of people. I feel like at the end of all this, there will be some shifts that'll at least unearth the bullshit that is the institution of higher ed, right? Because so much money does go into it. Like, so much. Like, UW-Madison, like, how many hundreds of millions of endowments, you know?
Yeah, I think the research department gets billions.
It's insane.
But see, and then that's where, oh, and that was another problem I had with going to college was the professors teaching us is like secondary to their job. Their first job is doing all the research and
research.
Stuff.
Research, yeah.
So it's like, well, like, why is this supposed to matter so much to me and you don't even really care about it?
Yeah.
Like, that
I definitely feel that. That's actually kind of the reason why, like, some of the best teachers or faculty, you'll see them at like second tier schools or like non-research one, like, you know, R1, like UW-Madison's R1, UCLA's R1. A lot of these like elite Ivy Leagues are R1, meaning research one university, because most of the money goes into research. But if you go to like a community college, for instance, you know, you have a faculty member there who's like there to teach. Yeah. You know, they're all about teaching. So they put all of their focus and energy into their students. When I was at Pace University, which is not an R1, it's actually not even that great of a school, that's in New York City, I had the best faculty because they didn't have that pressure to publish every single year. R1 universities, professors have to publish every single year, meaning they have to be researching nonstop all the time. And, you know, there are downsides to that, which is the students feel like, what the fuck? Yeah. Chop liver, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I almost wish I would have gone to... one of my choices of schools was UW Eau Claire, which is like some people would say like, oh, well, why would you choose Eau Claire over Madison? But after going to Madison, it's like, I probably should have gone there, actually.
Yeah.
Like just a smaller, more intimate vibe probably would have suited me better.
Yeah. A smaller, more intimate vibe actually does help people thrive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because like I went to Hunter College my freshman year, which was a public school, like hundreds of students in a lecture. And professors were like, They don't know who the fuck you are. Yeah. Like, I don't know who you are. But at Pace, like each class was capped at like 12, you know? So okay. Every professor knows who you are. Like to this day, I'm still... I know my classmates. I would be friends with them. I would like, you know, I still email some of my professors to this day. You know, we still stay in touch. But yeah, there is something to that. It's like the whole like industry thing, right? It's like, how do you maximize using... like one resource to maximize profit. Mm-hmm. And that is like a huge university setting, right?
Yeah.
But it's also like at some point, because it's an R1, why do they do research? It's because of publications, and publications lead to maybe press. Press leads to accolades. Accolades lead to more attention to the university, and the university can use that as, it's like marketing scheme.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm sure they find or like come up with great ideas or like whatever, like that's still an important job too.
Yeah.
But I feel like I don't know.
Right. We need John Locke's.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do need John Locke's, and we need the Hobbes, and we need all the thinkers. Yeah. And they do provide a very important service actually to humanity, which is like, how can we be better? Mm-hmm. You know, like, or how can we, just how can we be better? Yeah. Like not fuck one another up and like fuck society up. How can we be better thinkers? That is the job of thinkers. And those thinkers happen to be professors, and all professors happen to be PhDs, which is doctorate of philosophy. And that's what they are. That's what we are. We are philosophers. But it's like, yeah, who's getting the most attention? Like who has the mouthpiece? Who's getting the most research funding? Who's getting the safe, cushy position in order to sit around and think all day? Yeah?
Yeah. I actually had a professor one time. She like could tell I'd like was not giving a fuck about my...
Yeah.
Am I allowed to swear on you?
Yeah, you are.
Not giving a fuck about my classes. And I was, I don't know, showing up late, you know. I'd like show up late with a cup of coffee. So she knows like I stopped to get coffee. And then, you know. Yeah. And one time she like pulled me aside and was like... She basically told me like, you should probably drop out. And I was like, at the time I was like, you don't know me.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But honestly now I'm thinking like... She made a great call. She made a great read on me.
Right,
and
because college is expensive.
Yeah.
Right? Like tuition is expensive.
And she was actually like, said it because she had a similar experience. She was like, she was like, yeah, I went to college for like, I forget, probably like the same as me, like 3 or 4 years,
yeah.
And then took 10 years off and then went back to college.
Oh.
And she was like, you should think about like maybe doing that or something.
But so she wasn't being a dick. She was literally just offering life advice.
She sort of... It was coming off sort of rude. You know?
Well, yeah, because she is, like, kicking you out in a way. Yeah.
Making
you feel unwelcome.
Yeah. And it wasn't, like, from a caring tone. Or the tone seemed like a...
Oh.
You think you can come in here and...
Oh,
but then it sort of was good advice, too.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Okay.
So, yeah.
So, okay, there was a nugget of wisdom in there, but the delivery needed
delivery
some work.
Was off.
All right. So when did you start going to Comedy on Stage to do stand-up then? Was that like your first spot to start doing open mics or?
So how I started like getting into comedy was I actually started writing satire for the school newspaper.
Oh, nice.
And then I just started, to realize I'm more into creative things than I had previously thought.
Uh-huh.
And, because, like, all my favorite classes were something to do with creativity or something.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, you know what? I sort of want to, like, do more with comedy, not just satire. So I looked up. I knew about Comedy on State.
Yeah.
And I think I signed up there a couple times, but I'd just like go sit by myself, not make the list, and walk home. You know, like I did that like 3 or 4 times maybe.
Oh, wow.
Then like took a whole big break. And then the first time I ever did stand up was a senior, like a UW-Madison senior bar crawl. And we had been at like W Chasers 2.0, and then we went to Red Rock.
Oh my God.
So I'm already hammered.
Yeah, that's like a spot you get to when you're fucked.
Yeah. So I'm already hammered, and there's like all these seniors everywhere, which is sort of cool, but they're also all graduating, and I wasn't. So it was just an extra little bit of funniness on top. And there was an open mic going on at Red Rock, and I had already been thinking about doing comedy. And I had even like written some jokes. So I went up there and I tried to do comedy, and I was so nervous that I completely forgot like this part of this joke that I had. And it wasn't like I said the setup. It was sort of like a joke that had a setup and a punchline and then a setup and then a punchline, but they were like all connected. And I forgot the second half completely. I didn't even say it at all. So it like wasn't that funny at all. But people came up to me and were like, "Hey man, that was pretty good." And I'm drunk as hell and I'm like, "Fuck yeah." Awesome. Hell yeah.
All right. So your first comedy experience was at Red Rock. Jesus Christ. I actually had to pick up my partner from Red Rock because he was smashed. He lost his bike. He was with his friends. They had left and he just somehow wandered over there. And I brought the, I was like, "You're coming over, you're crossing the street." He's like, "No, we gotta go." I'm like, "I am not going in there. There's no way in hell I'm going into that hellhole." Yeah. It's so obnoxiously loud outside of that bar. Imagine going in. Like, I couldn't handle it.
Yeah, I hate that bar.
I hate that. I hate that area. Like, any
all those bars I just mentioned, I hate.
They're hateful. It's like, it's a place you go to after you pregame so you could numb yourself to the nightmare that those spaces are, and then you just only go there to get more shit-faced and then just you regret it.
I have this theory that those bars, or maybe it's just college kids in general, or maybe just UW-Madison kids in general, but I have this theory that those bars, like the people there, it's almost like a performative thing. Like they want to be like, "Oh, I'm, look at me, I'm drinking at the bar." Like I don't know, it's really weird. But then when you go to like a dive bar, it's just like everyone's just trying to hang out with their friends and have a good time.
It's like the music decibel is like reasonable. We can converse and hear one another. There's sports on. There's a you can shoot pool if you want.
Extremely drunk old guy over there
who everybody knows. He's there every day from like 11:30 a.m.
And he's only a little creepy.
He's just a tad, but he's harmless. Yeah, you know?
For the most part.
He'll call ladies like toots and stuff, but he's harmless.
He's catcalling, but it's just it's leaving a comment on a post.
Nobody takes him seriously. He has like 4 teeth. Nobody takes him seriously. But yeah, it's a dive I prefer. Yeah,
me too.
Those kinds of spaces, it's literally to like discombobulate your senses, I think.
Yeah.
It's to like abuse yourself.
Yeah, I wonder like... I don't know. Like,
what is the end game to that?
I don't know. What? Like, who wants to do that?
You come home deaf and mute.
Yeah.
No, it's no fun. All right. So, okay. You got any shows coming up?
I don't have any shows coming up, but I did. I think I'll be performing in the Madison Comedy Week again.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what I'm doing. They actually said they're supposed to post the performer list yesterday.
Oh.
And they didn't yet, but...
I'm sure they will very soon.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think it's good that that kind of system exists, because, like, especially if you want to, like, tour and stuff, and, like, do road stuff, then you kind of need, like, some kind of credit, and it's, like, that does... end up becoming a decent credit, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, that was last year, like, that opened my eyes to, like, what the Madison comedy scene is, and I was just like, whoa, like, this is, I don't know, I thought it was, like, because I only knew about, like, Argus, Moms, and I knew about Comedy on State, but, you know, like, I only knew about the small local scene. And then this was, like, a whole show where, like, bigger comedians were coming in, and I'm like, oh, like, this is, like, a real event, or,
yeah.
Something that comedians actually want to do. So it was cool.
So, like, what's the vision you have for yourself with, like, stand up?
I don't know. I just would love to be able to do comedy full time.
Yeah.
And not have to have another job.
Yeah. Not be a lobbyist anymore.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it. Like, I'm not trying to be like Kevin Hart or anything, or like, you know, I don't care. I just want to be able to do comedy and that's it, basically.
And make a living.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, I've obviously, you know, like, I know a few of the Madison comics now, including you. But yeah, like, I would say, like, among the Madison comics here, like, I would say, like, you're definitely, like, one of the funnier ones. Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely think that that's, like, a doable dream, you know? I mean, like, you didn't even finish college and you work full time as a lobbyist. That's, like, that's a sign of something, right?
Well, I also, speaking of that, I just, like, my brain is a constant battle of me being, like, I could, like, easily be a headlining comedian, and then also, like, I fucking suck at comedy, you know? Same with my job. I'm like, I could easily do this, and then I'm like, oh my god, I'm doing everything wrong, you know? Like, so.
I think that's literally how every single artist thinks. Yeah. Yeah. They're, like, super high on themselves, full of hubris, and then the most insecure, self-loathing motherfucker you'll ever meet. It's like,
and then they, like, I don't know, feed off each other and, like, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. There's no in-between. No. In fact, if there is an in-between, then you're stagnant.
Yeah.
Something's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that's, like, how my, like, comedy career goes, or just, like, my day-to-day. I'll say month-to-month. Because, okay. Like, I'll have a month where I'm like, dude, I am on fire. Like, yeah, get me to Argus, get me to Rigby, you know, and then the next month I'm like, I'm never doing comedy ever again.
Yeah, I think that's pretty normal. I mean, you know, it's like, we do stand-up because it's fun, right? I mean, or why do you do it? Like, what does it do for you?
Yeah, well, I tell my friends this, and, like, honestly, until I started doing comedy, I'd never really understood, like, joy, to be honest, like, huh. on some deep shit. Like, I used to, I don't know, and that's another reason why I dropped out of college. I just felt like out of place. Nothing like felt like, oh, this feels good, you know?
Yeah.
And then I get off stage and I'm like, whoa, like, this is like a feeling people get, you know? Like,
yes.
So that was, I don't know, I like to be creative. I like to make people laugh, and it also makes me feel good. So it's like a two birds, one stone kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I get that. Yeah, I think, I mean, that's probably like the basic reason why all comics do stand up is because, you know, getting that laugh, it just like, it's like a needle to the vein.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just it's a cool feeling. And it's also like, I don't know, it's like cool, like we're all experiencing this together, or like, yeah. And then I do have a little bit of selfishness to it, where it's like, wow, they laughed at something I came up with, you know, and I think that's cool.
Yeah. It's just like, I think it's like healthy to have a little bit of that.
Yeah.
They call it like healthy ego. Mm-hmm. You know, there is like, you know, ego is often framed as like, oh, you're not supposed to have an ego. But it's like, no, there is such a thing as healthy ego. Especially for people who want to do stand up, it's like there's already something wrong with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's already something wrong with us. We're all broken. We're fucked in some way. That's why we want to stand up on stage in front of strangers and like tickle them.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's funny. I think part of the reason why I like stand up too is like, I'm not a huge extrovert. Like if I'm in I won't like command a conversation, you know, or like, I don't know. Is that what extroverts do? So like when I'm on stage, it's like, okay, this is my time, you know, like,
yeah.
You can't interrupt me, or like,
yeah.
You know, sometimes in like normal conversation, I might have something funny to say, unless I'm with like my real true friends, but, so I might have something funny to say, but like, I just like can't get a word in or something like, and then stand up is like, all right, listen to me now.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, she was another guest on my podcast, but very, very talented, funny comedian, Crystal Adams, she said this. She was like, I like doing stand-up because I don't have to put that much energy into, like, talking. Mm-hmm. Like, and nobody's interrupting me. Yeah. She was like, and I love that. And I was like, oh, fascinating. I never thought of it that way. But yeah, you're another Crystal Adams. Yeah, very, yeah, very, you know, wise mind, deep thoughts. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who knew that Will Franken was such a philosopher, eh? Who knew this?
I didn't even know.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I do this on all of my podcasts with guests, especially with comedy guests. And basically, I take a show, I take a K-drama, and then I take situations from that, like scenarios from that and characters from that. And then I ask you, like, what would you do as this character in this situation? Right. Yeah. And then you just like riff off of it. It's nothing, nothing difficult. Right. No pressure on this. There's no right or wrong. Yeah. Yeah. Take a sip of water. All right. So the show that we're going to discuss today is called When Life Gives You Tangerines. Written by the same screenwriter who wrote When the Camellias Bloom and When Life Gives You Tangerines. Really excellent show starring IU and Park Bo-gum. So let's say you're an orphaned girl named Aesun. All right. You're living on an island called Jeju Island. And you're a child. You're like maybe 11 years old, 12 years old. All right. You run for class president. Okay. And you win the most votes. All right. You got the most votes in class.
Let's go.
All right. But then the teacher gives the president's title to a boy who was the runner up. Okay. And then you become vice president. So you ask the teacher, like, why is he the VP? I got the most votes. And he's like, first of all, this kid has a very wealthy father who brought in a bunch of snacks. He's like, you ate those snacks. Did you bring snacks? No. So there you go. And the teacher doesn't budge on this. He's basically like, you're not president because you're too poor. We don't care about the votes. What do you do?
Now, I have to be in the mind of a little kid.
You're a 12-year-old girl.
I don't even know. I would, how I am, I probably would like, I'd start yelling at people probably.
Just random people? What would you yell?
I don't know. I'm like, that guy fucking sucks. I won the votes. He might be rich, but he's a dumbass. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I do.
All right. So you would just scream it out.
I'd probably scream it out. Oh, yeah. I'd probably scream it out.
Randomly. Just get the rage out.
Or so the teacher, so this is how it goes. The teacher's like, oh, well, because his dad's super rich. And I go, you know what? Fuck you. I'm a little kid too. Fuck you. Yeah, that's what
So you just say fuck you to the teacher.
I think so. I'd probably say some more. I'd probably get angry and then start saying who knows what.
So all kinds of shit.
And then the little kids would also start crying. So I'm angry crying. But then I think in this scenario, since I'm a little 11-year-old girl, I think I'm going to like sprinkle in that I also have a crush on this guy that won anyway.
Oh, okay.
So now I'm torn because he stole the election from me, but I also am in love with this man.
Yeah, like you're like willing to become first lady.
Yeah, yeah. Even. But maybe like give me some more responsibilities.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you would be like, you know what, maybe I'll just accept the VP position / first lady position and let love take over rather than my rage. Exactly. How interesting. You went through a lot just now. This is like a lot of
it's abstract thinking.
Very, very intense emotional journey. Okay. All right, you're the same girl, right? Let's say you're Aesun again, okay? You're now like 18 years old, all right? You're in high school now. Your favorite thing to do is to read books, all right? You're very much a literary kind of person. You love to read. Your dream is to become a poet someday, all right? That is your dream. You write in your notebook all the time, all right? And you want to get off this island. You want to move to a big city on the mainland. You want to make it big as a writer, okay? But there's this local boy. He's a year older than you. His name is Kwan Shik. And you've known each other since you guys were little children, okay? Childhood friends. He likes you, all right? You actually like him too. But he's just as poor as you are, not really educated. He asks you to be his wife. What do you do?
I'd probably tell him, and this is just real, I'd probably tell him, hey man, like, I might be down, but I'm also like trying to move. So like, if you're trying to move, then maybe we can make it work. But I'm trying to move.
So it's like, if he moves with you to the city, then it's a go. But if he wants to stay put on that island and make you his wife, you're like, no.
Yeah. But, well, it depends. Well, so it depends. I'm like trying to think of like what the character would think and like what I would think.
No, no, be the character.
Okay, yeah. I'm the character, because I feel like the character, their ambition is to leave. So yeah, it would have to be that way. Because okay. Unless all of a sudden, like the next page of the story,
yeah,
they're like, oh, falling head over heels in love. Then it's like, eh. I think, like, it just depends what the, you know, if you value love more than...
What would you do?
Well, see, that's the thing is, if it was, like, some crazy feeling, I'd probably stay.
Oh, interesting. Again, but, you're letting love win.
Yeah. Well... And I have this theory in my real life, because you see a lot of people like, oh, I need to get out of here. I need to get out of this city. Oh, like, sure. Especially growing up in Madison, a lot of people sort of say that.
Yeah.
But I just feel like that's not, or like they think they'll move and all their problems are going to be solved. But
yeah.
You, like, if you're miserable here, you're probably going to be miserable somewhere else.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Like, so.
They'll end up in New York with a heroin addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, whenever I've heard people be like, oh, I need to get out of here, I've always been like, well, I mean, sure, it's not, like, the best place, but...
But you can't run away from yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can't.
You take that with you.
Yeah, yeah. Some people don't know that.
Interesting. All right, how interesting. You're very much a romantic. You let love win. Okay, all right.
Yeah, but okay. It's weird because, like, I'm not really. I think I'm only romantic if it's storybook romance, you know.
Okay.
I'm not trying to...
If you are the prince in the story, then you're like, oh, yeah. But you're like, me and me? You're like, nah. Okay. All right. Well, let's say you're Isun again, okay? Kwanshik's family, this guy, his family hates you. They hate you. They're like, you're an orphan girl. You're basically a broke-ass beggar. Like, they won't accept you, all right? So, you and Kwanshik, you guys decide to run away in the middle of the night, all right? You guys run away, pack your bags, run away to a city, a nearby city. But then your bags and your wallet and all the jewelry that he stole from his mother and grandmother, they all get stolen, all right? You have no food, no money, nowhere to go. You're on the streets. What do you do?
My comedian brain immediately went to, I gotta sell my body. I gotta sell my body. You know, we gotta make a living.
That's all you got.
And what else am I gonna do?
And it's an asset.
Yeah.
You know? All right. Yeah.
And I'm good at what I do.
Sex work is real work. Yeah. It's true labor. Okay. All right. Great. All right. Let's say you're the same chick. You're Isun again. You and your boyfriend, you guys returned to the island, okay? Like, his mom came and, like, fucking found you guys and brought you guys back. But the high school you used to attend, they expel you because they're like, you're used goods. Yeah, you're a floozy who ran away with a boy in the middle of the night. Who knows what you did? And they are like, you slut, get out of here. They expel you. But Kwanshik gets to continue with schooling. He gets to stay on the swim team. He has a big swim meet, okay? But you're expelled from school. You have no job, nowhere to go. You're fucked. Now, your aunt, she sets you up with an older man who is a widow. He has two children, okay? And what this is what he's propositioning. He's like, if you marry me, and you raise my children, then I will let you go to school. What do you do?
Do I have to have sex with him?
You marry the guy. It's all...
Can't do it.
Can't do it? How interesting. On the streets, you're willing to sell your body.
For sure.
But in an actual marriage with this widow, you're like, no go.
No. It seems... I'm like a prisoner at that point. Whereas if I'm selling my body, I'm my own boss.
Okay, so that was the deciding factor. It's like, do I get to be CEO or not? Oh, okay. So it has to do with agency. Fascinating. All right. Great, great. All right. So let's say now you're the guy, you're Kwanshik, okay? You're on a boat, you're headed to the mainland, all right, in order to do this massive swim meet competition thing. And you're a good swimmer. You're actually one of the best, okay? So you have a future doing this. But then you hear that Isun is about to get married to an older widow with two children, okay? And like while you're on this ship, you hear her voice like calling from you from the bay. What do you do?
What, the ship is like docked still?
No, it is sailing.
Well, then I'd just be like, shit. It's close.
Guess it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, I'm not jumping off. I got a race to win.
Yeah, I have to swim in a pool, not in the ocean.
I can't ruin my taper.
Okay. All right. Let's say you're Isun, all right? You and Kwanshik, you guys get married. Yeah, you guys get married. You give birth to a daughter, okay? So you have a baby. You guys move in with his mother and his grandmother, okay?
Do they still hate me?
They treat you like trash. They curse you out every day. They make you do all this labor. They are mean to your daughter. They call you names, and they just treat you like utter garbage. What do you do?
I wouldn't stand for that.
Okay, so what would you do?
I'd probably be like, yo, dog, we gotta move out of here.
Oh, to your husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To my husband. Yo, we gotta move out of here, because this is absolutely ridiculous. Or you gotta talk to them and be like, put some respect on my name. Like, I'm like, your son married me.
Yeah.
You know, like, you don't have to love me, but you don't have to, or like,
yeah,
you don't need to be my best friend, but like, come on.
That may be basic civil respect. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And then like, then I'd be like, and this is me in character, I'd be like, making fun of my daughter is where I draw the line. You can make fun of me all you want.
But leave my daughter out of it. Oh, okay. Very much a mama bear. You let the mama bear come out.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's great. All right. This is great. You're doing great.
Heck yeah.
All right. All right. Let's say you're Isun.
I'm going to get graded.
So far, it's an A. All right. Let's say you're Isun again. All right. You're now pregnant with your second child. Yeah. You're a busy lady. You and Kwanshik move out of that house. Okay. Because you can't stand them anymore. And you rent a room. Okay. You guys are barely making ends meet. Okay, because now you have rent to pay, you know, there's no childcare, you have to like watch the kid all the time, can't work, right? One day, your husband, Kwanshik, comes home with a huge hand injury. Like, his hand is fucked, all right, while working on a fishing boat. Turns out that fishing boat is owned by that widow that you turned down, okay? And that widow is pretty sour about that, and he hits your husband, calls him all kinds of names, and he doesn't pay his wages on time. What do you do?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one, because it seems like, because my first thought was, I don't know, do some type of civil lawsuit or something, but I'm poor in this situation.
Broke as shit.
That's not viable.
Yeah.
Let's see. I don't know.
Yeah, you guys are barely making ends meet. And your husband hurt his hand.
I mean, the only thing you could do, there's two options. Either, like, I don't know, try to yell at the guy, or you try to talk to the guy, but he seems like a stubborn old bag, so neither is probably going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of fucked. I think I'd be like, well, that's it. We're fucked.
I guess we're fucked.
Yeah.
You just live with it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, that's still an answer. All right, let's say you're Kwanshik now. You're the husband, okay? The captain of your boat is hitting you, kicking you, withholding your wages. He calls your wife a slut. From way out in the distance, you see your pregnant wife running over to where you two are standing, where this captain guy is like kicking you in the shins. She's running towards you guys, calling him a son of a bitch. And she runs over and she kicks the captain right in the shins. What do you do?
Well, it depends what he does right after the kick lands.
He's going like this. Owie, ow, my shin.
I'd probably talk shit. Like, yeah, bitch. That's what you get. Treat some people with respect. You know, something like that. Now, if he were to have, like, looked aggressive after, I probably would start beating his ass.
Okay, so it's all going to be words until he turns aggro.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, wonderful.
But like, really instigating words. So if a fight does break out, it's sort of going to be my fault. But I'm like, I didn't swing first, though.
Yeah. It's true. He was the one that was being violent. You were just taking it the whole time.
Yeah.
And then your wife came over and then retaliated. Okay. All right, last question. Let's say you're Isun, all right? You're older now. You're like in your 50s now, all right? Your daughter, she is in her 20s. And she is engaged to a man who comes from immense wealth. All right. Yeah. He's a city boy. He went to a great school, the same school that your daughter went to. All right. But then you find out that your daughter's fiance's mother hates your daughter. And when she asked why, she's like, I don't like you because your parents are uneducated and poor and you have no assets and you're marrying into an advantage and you are just like a thorn in my side. What do you do?
I mean, in that situation, I feel like it's honestly, well, I would probably tell my daughter. I mean, I dealt with the same shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's going to be tough. It sucks dick, but you'll get through it. But then as far as addressing the mother-in-law or whatever,
yeah.
I mean, you can't really say anything. I don't even think I would say anything, to be honest. Like, really? If that's what you think, that's what you think. I mean, who am I to, I don't know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no use in saying something or starting something more than you're just going to use that as fuel to hate my daughter right. Even more. So
because she's already decided to hate.
Exactly, like. It's like, and it's like, they're together, so, you know, I don't know. I'd just be like, whatever.
Whatever? Yeah. Okay, that's still haters an answer. Haters gone hate. All right, that wraps it up. Well, thank you so much for being a guest.
Thanks for having me on. This was fun.